We are in Acts 17, and we have made it to one of the most famous passages, not just in the book of Acts, but in all of Scripture. But, letting you know right now, that we're not actually going to get to Paul's famous speech at the Areopago today, because there's just too much going on, and we're only going to be looking at the verses leading up to his speech before the intellectuals and the philosophers. So our passage today is going to be Acts 17, starting in verse 16, and we're going to read to verse 23, right at the beginning of his speech. So Acts 17, verse 16, Luke writes, "Now while Paul waited for them," that's Silas and Timothy, "while he waited for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he saw that the city was given over to idols. Therefore, he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and with the Gentile worshippers and in the marketplace daily with those who happened to be there. Then, certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers encountered him, and some said, 'What does this babbler want to say?' Others said, 'He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods, because he preached to them Jesus and the resurrection.' And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, the Areopagos, saying, 'May we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak? For you're bringing some strange things to our ears. Therefore we want to know what these things mean. For all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing.' Then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, 'Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you.'" We will stop right there. I need to remember from the previous weeks, Paul is traveling through Greece. He went to Philippi, where he was beaten, thrown into jail, and then sent out. Then he went to Thessalonica, where there were a bunch of riots caused, and he had to leave the city. Then he went to Berea, where again there were riots, and he had to leave the city. And if you remember the last two verses from last week, look at verse 14. It says, "Then immediately the brethren in Berea sent Paul away to go to the sea, but both Silas and Timothy remained there. So those who conducted Paul brought him to Athens, and receiving a command for Silas and Timothy to come to him with all speed, they departed." So the brethren in Berea, they take him down to the sea. There's a debate amongst theologians. It's really not a big deal. But some people, because it doesn't say that he actually got on a boat and came down to Athens. And usually when he does get on a boat, the scripture says so. So they said maybe he didn't actually take a boat. Maybe he went down to the sea as a trick, so people would think that he was getting on a boat and leaving, and instead he walked down to Athens by the coast. We don't know. That's a long way to go. That's over 400 kilometers from there. But either way, he gets down to Athens. They bring him to Athens, and then the people who brought him, they leave, and he says, "But tell Silas and Timothy to come down quickly." Because he's by himself. This is the first time in his missionary journeys that he's by himself. Every time he goes on a missionary journey, he's with someone. On his first missionary journey, he took Barnabas and Mark. Mark abandoned him along the way, but that's a different issue. He was with Barnabas all the way along. Then on the second one, he takes Silas, and he takes Timothy, and then he meets Luke along the way, and all these things. But now, he's by himself in Athens, and his closest companions are way far away. Now, he's in Athens, so a few words, just a few words about Athens then. Athens was no longer the enormous, great, important city that it was in the past. In the 5th century BC, it was its golden age, shall we say, under Pericles. Since then, it had been conquered by Macedonia, Alexander the Great, and then now it's under the Roman rule. So politically or militarily, shall we say, Athens at this point is nothing special. Its population is not that big. It's not even the capital of this region. The capital of the region was Corinth at this point. But Even now, at this point in history, in Paul's day, it still remained the cultural center of the world. If you wanted to learn about the arts, or about architecture, or about philosophy, or literature, or any of these things, you went to Athens. And so, even then, as today, Athens was full of tourists. Tourists going to Athens because they wanted to be in this, to see all these things, and learn all these things. And the first thing that Paul would have seen as he was approaching Athens would have been this big rock, the Acropolis with the Parthenon standing on there. Back then, you could basically see it from anywhere in Athens or the surrounding area. Probably today, I mean, you could probably see it from here right now if it wasn't for all the buildings in the way. You'd be able to see the Acropolis because it's right there sticking up. And with the temple, with the Parthenon, with the temple to Athena, the patron goddess of the city. And so most people, when they went to Athens, they went to see all these things, amazing things, and they were amazed in awe of the grandeur and the beauty and the buildings and the statues and all these things. Even today, when people come, they look at the Parthenon, wow, it's still standing there after 2,500 years. It's amazing. It's a monument to human achievement, what people can do when they put their minds to it. But Paul gets there, and I'm not saying he didn't appreciate art. I'm not saying he didn't appreciate any of these things, but what he sees, what is in his mind as soon as he arrives, is idolatry. Idolatry everywhere. Verse 16 says, "Now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he saw that the city was given over to idols." The 16th century reformer John Calvin said that man by nature is an idol factory. What we do is we don't want the true God, so we create other gods that are more like us, gods that are not necessarily scary and holy and righteous and just. We don't want a God like that because we know we're not that good. So if we have a holy, just God, he's going to end up punishing us. So we create gods that are like us. And that's what the Greeks did. They would create, if you look at the ancient Greek mythology of the gods, they had, the gods were not nice. They were liars. They were adulterers. There were all kinds of stuff. And so, but it's okay, you see, because if I go and commit adultery or lie or whatever, the God is not going to judge me because he's like me. He understands why I do what I do. The gods, they're like us. And people are like that today. They create a God in their own mind of what God should be like. And, you know, you say to people, "Oh, what's your relationship with God?" "Oh, we're fine. We're fine. Everything's okay with me and God," because they think God is like them. And that's what they did in ancient Athens, except then they were very extremely artistic. And they didn't just have these false gods in their minds, but they made statues and images of these gods. And so the city was just flooded with idols everywhere. An ancient writer, this is not just someone assuming something, an ancient writer said, if you go to Athens, you can find more gods than people. So it's just crazy. And Paul, we are told, his spirit was provoked within him. I remember, you know, I grew up within the Greek Orthodox Church. Now, it's true that I was not, it's not like I was the most religious person. It's not like I went to church on Sunday. I was more of a nominal Greek Orthodox, but, you know, I was baptized in the Greek Orthodox Church when I was a baby. Anytime that I did go to church, it was the Greek Orthodox Church. And you go in and there's just icons everywhere. Everywhere. You can't, everywhere. Walls, ceiling, everywhere. And you all go in, You line up and you bow down in front of the picture and you kiss the picture of Mary or the saints or Jesus, or they even have pictures of God the Father. And by the way, God the Father is not an old gray-haired man. Okay? Now, the Lord saved me when I was about 19. And I didn't go to a Greek Orthodox church for a few years. And then I don't remember what it was. It was a wedding. Maybe someone in my family or someone was getting married. So I went. And what I didn't used to mind, all of a sudden I walk in and it's like, and you know, all the people lining up to bow down in front of the image and kiss it. You know, let's lift up the 3-year-old that can't reach so it can kiss the image. And I was just, I don't know how to describe how I felt. It's a mixture of sorrow and anger and disgust and just too much idolatry right now. This is not for me. And I don't know for sure, but it seems to me that perhaps this is something of how Paul felt when he enters into Athens. He's a Jew. Okay, he's a Jew. They do not have images of God. He knew the first commandment, I am your God, you shall have no other gods before me. He knew the second commandment, do not bow down to images. He's like, absolutely not. And so he goes in, and he's shocked. The word that is used, paroxysmos, where we get paroxysm, is a very, very strong term. It's talking about, it's a very negative term, and it's about angry. He's angry. He can't handle it there. This word that is used here is actually used many times in the Old Testament, in the Septuagint, in the Greek translation, the ancient Greek translation of the Old Testament. This word that is used here for Paul, where it says that his spirit was provoked, is the same word that is used of God many times, repeatedly in the Old Testament, for his anger against idolatry. Every time he talks about his anger, his wrath against idolatry, it uses this word. When he talks about being jealous and his jealousy is burning hot, it uses this word. And I know a lot of people read the Old Testament where it says God is a jealous God, and they say, that's not right. Jealous is something bad, isn't it? Jealous is when you see something that's not yours and you want it, and you want to take it for yourself, you want to have it and not them. But there is such a thing as a good, holy jealousy, since God is a jealous God. What does that mean? Example. If you have a married couple who are in a holy, sacred union, which is a picture of Christ and his church, if one of the two cheats on the other, I would hope that the other one does not just say, oh well, doesn't matter. I would expect them to have a correct jealousy. We are in a sacred union. A third person is not welcome to come into this. I would expect them to get angry. If you love someone, you're not indifferent. And so God, in the Old Testament, is very angry when he sees his people turning away to those things which are not even gods. They're just pieces of stone. They don't even exist. And so here, Paul seems to have the same heart as God on this matter. He cannot stand idolatry. And so he is grieved and he is angry when he reaches Athens, which is full of idols. Now, I don't know what Paul's initial plan was, because he's by himself. He wasn't expecting to be chased out of Thessalonica. He wasn't expecting to be chased out of Berea. So he ends up in Athens and he's by himself. I don't know what his initial plan was. It may have been, I'm just going to wait for Timothy and Silas until they get here and then I'll go start preaching or whatever, but maybe I'll just go see the sights and sounds for now while I'm a tourist, whatever. But he is so provoked in his spirit that he's got to say something. He's got to speak. So he goes by himself. Verse 17. It says, therefore, he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and with the Gentile worshippers and in the marketplace daily with those who happened to be there. So as always, first thing he does, goes to the synagogue, speaks to the Jews and to the God-fearing Gentiles. I do wonder, the first words there in verse 17 is the word therefore. You know, his spirit is provoked because of all the idols. Therefore, he reasoned in the synagogue. I wonder if there's some connection there. I wonder if it's more than just, look what the Old Testament says about the Messiah, so it's Jesus. I wonder if there's, are you saying anything about these idols? Does this not bother you? You Jews here in the synagogue, how can you live here? I don't know if there was any of that. It doesn't specifically say that, but I'm just wondering if that's something that came up. But it also says that he went and he spoke in the marketplace daily with those who happened to be there. The Greek word there, agora. The agora, which is right under the Acropolis, you can go there today and see it. Literally today, you can go and see it. Off the church. Right under the Acropolis is this, the ruins there. The agora, when it says marketplace, it wasn't merely a place where you went to get groceries. You could do that, but it was more, I was trying to find an example, and I couldn't really get exactly an example of something today that is like it. The best thing that I could do was something like a mall, but way more than that. Yes, you could go shopping, but it would have restaurants. It could have places where you could sit down and talk about anything, about religion, about philosophy. You could find gymnasiums. You could find everything that happened in life was there. Everything that happened in social life was there in the agora. And so Paul says, all right, that's where everything is done. That's where I'm going to go, and I'm going to stand up amongst these people that I don't know, got no one watching my back. I'm going to stand up and preach about Jesus and to whoever listens. That's what he does. And interestingly enough, he catches the attention of some philosophers. Verse 18. It says, then certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers encountered him. And some said, what does this babbler want to say? Others said, he seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods because he preached to them Jesus and the resurrection. Now, in that day in Athens, there were many different forms of philosophy. Many. This is just two of them. And these schools of philosophy disagreed vastly on most issues. But at this point in the history of Athens, there was one thing that most of them had in common. And that was everyone had become rather skeptic about whether it was possible to reach absolute truth. Each one had their opinions, but no one was 100% sure if we have reached absolute truth. And the reason that happened was that for centuries, Athens was known for its philosophy. And you had had giants of philosophy, whether it's Parmenides or Heraclitus or Socrates or Plato or Aristotle, all these people. But the problem is, all these people who were giants of philosophy, they all disagreed with one another. They all disagreed. And people were like, well, if you have Plato and Aristotle, two of the greatest minds who ever lived, and they don't agree on what truth is, how could we ever know? And so everyone just kind of had their own philosophy, thinking, well, maybe this is true, maybe that is true. Who knows? And even though they considered themselves to be wise, I'm a philosopher, I'm in the intellectual elite, everyone taught different things. And here we have these two groups, and I want to give you just a few words about these two groups, and I'm not just doing this to pass the time, I'm not just doing this to look knowledgeable or anything like that. I think it's important to know what these two groups believed, to some degree. I'm just going to give it to you quickly, because when Paul starts his speech at the Areopago, it's not just a standard pre-prepared sermon that I just give to everyone. He knows what they believe, and he gives them the gospel. He doesn't change the gospel. The gospel is the same, but he applies it to the situation which he is in. Every time a Jehovah Witness comes to my door, they have a set thing of verses. And they expect me to kind of fall in line, and I'm not their usual person they meet, and everything is messed up. Well, Paul goes and he finds different people and he preaches the truth, but accordingly. And so next week when we go through the sermon, we'll see how the things that he says are specifically addressed to these philosophers because of what they believed. And so I think it would be helpful to know a few things about them. Just a few. And I'll remind you again next week. You have the Epicureans, the first group, which started by a guy named Epicurus. Okay, that was easy. A few centuries earlier. Epicurus said, yeah, they believed in the existence of gods, but the gods were so far detached from everything, they really had nothing to do with us. They existed, but they didn't get involved in everyday life, or with anything that we did. That's basically what they believed. There's no judgment when you die. There's no afterlife. The gods do their own thing. People do their own thing. That's it. Gods don't really have anything to do with us. And since there's no judgment, there's no afterlife, there's no gods that are involved with us, they said the ultimate truth, the ultimate the reality to follow is that of pleasure. Their basic philosophy was, if it feels good, it must be good. Right? And so their main philosophy was, try and seek pleasure, and try and avoid pain. That's the essence of life. Now, there were some people who believe that and go to extremes. These people did not go to extremes. It wasn't as simplistic as it sounds. Because they were like, yeah, let's go have a drink. But they realized, well, if I drink too much, though, I could get drunk, and that won't be good, you know, have hangovers and all kinds of stuff. So if I'm going to drink, yes, but not to the extreme. If I'm going to be indulging in other areas of life, you know, be careful, don't go too far, you don't want to get diseases or anything like that, so just, you know, just everything in moderation. Everything in moderation, but try and live life without pain and enjoy yourself. That was basically what the Epicureans believed. The Stoics are completely different. The Stoics said, we don't really know why things happen, why the world is the way it is. We don't know why there is pain in the world. Therefore, it's our job to just take it. Just be patient and endure it. That was their goal. Their attitude was basically, whatever will be, there's nothing you can do about the things that happen in life, therefore we just kind of sit there and endure it patiently and calmly. Alright, that's enough about the philosophers. We'll get into them more next week when we look into Paul's sermon. So, these people who have completely different views, they come to Paul. And they've never heard these things before. They have no clue what he's talking about. What he is saying has nothing to do with the philosophy that they've preached. He's talking about Jesus and the resurrection. No Greek believed in resurrection. So they have no clue what he's talking about. And they come and they say, some of them say, what is this babbler talking about? I like that. Because it's like, we are the intellectuals, we're the philosophers, and this guy is talking about stuff that we've never heard before. What does this babbler have to say? But it's more interesting because the Greek word that is used there, spermologos, is very strange. It actually means a seed picker. You're like, what on earth does that mean? A seed picker was a reference to a bird that would fly around, take a seed from there, 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 and they used it for people who would get a bit of knowledge from here, get a bit of knowledge from there, get an idea from there, get an idea from there, and then they would present it as though they really knew what they were talking about, but they weren't. They were ignorant. And so they come and they say, what is this seed picker talking about? He doesn't know what he's talking about. Look, to explain what a seed picker is, because I have met a lot of seed pickers when it comes to theology. You have people who, the extent of their theology is like, oh, well, I watched the miniseries, you know, Jesus of Nazareth at Easter time, and I watched the Da Vinci Code, and I watched, I don't know, some documentary on TV. And then they come and they talk to you, pretending that they know what they're talking. They've never studied theology. They've never studied the Bible. They've never studied church history. They've never studied any of this thing. And they're pretending that they know what they're talking about. And you're like, you really don't know what you're talking about. I had a guy. This was so interesting. I had this guy one time. He heard that I was a pastor. What happens when you tell someone you're a pastor, there's two options. Sometimes they just kind of, oh, I don't want to talk about that. But sometimes they try to talk about theology. That's fine. I had a guy once come to me and he was like, yeah, well, you know, what Christians believe today is not what Christians believed 2,000 years ago. He said, you know, Christians believed in reincarnation 2,000 years ago. And I said, really? Christians believed in reincarnation, you say? He said, yeah. I said, I'm assuming that you have some kind of proof for this, right? Well, I'm assuming you didn't just hear this off some random person or saying this. I'm assuming you have some kind of documentation to prove it, right? He's like, well, I mean, well, can you prove that they didn't believe in reincarnation? I said, yes. We have the letter to the Hebrews, which is a Christian writing from the first century. And in Hebrews chapter 9, it says, it is appointed for man to die once, and then there's the judgment. It's not that he dies and then comes again to life and dies again and then reappears as something else and dies again. No, you die once, and then there's the judgment by God. Oh, well, I don't know. I'm not sure. You know, I don't know, kind of a thing. And it's like, yeah, that's a seed picker. All right? That's a person who doesn't, he's pretending that he knows what he's talking about because he's assuming that most people won't be able to answer these things. So these people who have never heard of anything like this before, they think he's just some babbler. And like, what is this babbler talking about? Of course, Paul was not a babbler. He was not a seed picker. But because he was not talking philosophy, they assumed that he didn't know what he was talking about. Others said, he seems to be talking about foreign gods, because they've never heard of Jesus or the resurrection. And so they say, all right, let's take him to the Areopago. And let me do a quick side note here. And this is just for, how can I put this? This is just a little pet peeve that I have. Well, I'll just say it and move on. It drives me crazy when people say Mars Hill instead of Areopago. Okay? It's not a big deal, but I'm like, because here's the thing. Areopago. Here's the two words, okay? Let me tell you really quick. Areopago. That's what the word. The word Areos comes from Ares, which is the Greek god of war. Mars is the Roman god of war. And you'll say, oh, it's the equivalent. Yeah, okay. Well, these people are Greeks. They're not Romans. Okay? The name is Ares, not Mars. Secondly, the word Pagos does not mean hill. The word Pagos refers to something that is solid and immovable. And some people will say, well, that's probably referring to the little hill where they met. Maybe, maybe, maybe not. Because it's quite, because the word, the phrase Areos Pagos is not simply a reference to a place. It's a reference to a council, a group of people. And so it's quite possible that these people, because of their authority and their power that they had as a council, they called themselves the solidarity, the solidness, the immovable group of who they were because of their power. And so when it's called the Areos Pagos, it's literally the immovability and solidarity of Ares, of Ares. Okay, so just throwing that out, it's a council. And it's called the Areos Pagos. So, okay, moving on. The Areos Pagos, as I said, is a council, and they dealt with all kinds of stuff. They did trials. They would get together to make rules and regulations for civil life, for education, for religion, for all kinds of stuff. And so they're like, okay, here's a guy who's teaching some kind of new religion. Let's take him to the Areos Pagos and see what they're going to say. So verse 19, it says, and they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak? For you're bringing some strange things to our ears, therefore we want to know what these things mean. And I like verse 21, for all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. This is Luke's, I was reading a commentary and someone said, this may be Luke's way of trying to get back at these people for calling his friend a babbler. Because he's basically saying they just kind of waste their time just talking about the next philosophical thing that comes up. So that's all they do. Well, Paul speaks. Here we go. Let's just look at the beginning. Here we go. Verse 22. Then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you. He arrives. He says, first thing that he says is, I can see that you're very religious. Couple of things about that. Number one, if you're reading in King James or some other translations perhaps also, it says, I can see that you're very superstitious. The Greek word, dissidemon, can have two meanings. If you want to use it, you can use it in a negative way or you can use it in a positive way. In the negative way, it means superstitious. In a positive way, if you're trying to be polite, it means religious. And so most translators say, well, he's standing up in front of a group of people that he doesn't know, and so he's going to try and be polite to them, so they put in religious. And that may be very well the case, but if you know anything about Paul's theology, even being called religious is not a compliment. If you go to Romans chapter 1, Paul says, all people know that there is a God. They can see creation, they have their conscience, by nature, they can see, they know that there is a God. But what do? Romans 1, they suppress that knowledge in unrighteousness. But what's the result of that? I think you all remember Romans 1. The result of that, when they suppress the knowledge of the true God, is not becoming atheists, it's becoming idolaters. They want to worship something because they know that there's a God, but they don't want to worship the true God. So they become idolaters. They're very religious. All people. Look at history. Look at the world. Most people are not atheists. They're very religious. They worship statues or icons or cows or the sun or the moon or whatever, but not the true God. And the Athenians were just like that. They were very religious. That's true. They had all these idols. They had many gods. But he says, Paul sees that amongst all these altars and statues and all these things that they had, there was an altar that said, to the unknown God, or to an unknown God. And a lot of Greek people today who don't want to admit that their forefathers were idolaters, look at this verse and they say, ah, you see? They say, this verse means that the ancient Greeks, they knew that there was one true God. They knew that their gods, you know, the gods of Olympus, they knew that those weren't the true gods. And they were seeking the one true God that they mentioned here, the unknown God. No, that's not what's going on at all. The Greeks had so many gods that they assumed that there have to be other gods also somewhere. Whenever they made an altar, whenever in everything in life, if they wanted to take a trip by sea, they would sacrifice something to Poseidon. If they were falling in love with someone, maybe they'd sacrifice Aphrodite or you know, whatever. They would have all these different gods to whom they went to and sacrificed for different reasons. And they assumed that they have to be more gods. It can't be just these ones because there's so many gods. And so just to cover all bases, just to make sure that we don't make any God angry that we don't know about, let's have altars and sacrifices to unknown gods so that they can be happy with us so we don't offend anyone. This is not our gods are wrong and we know that there's one true one and we're waiting for the Christians to come tell us. This is, these gods are true and there have to be more also. And that's why they had this altar. And it wasn't just one. Historically, we know that they had many of these kinds of altars to the unknown gods. But this is what Paul uses as his introduction. He says, you are talking about this unknown God. Well, I am here to tell you about this God who is known, who has revealed himself. He's not hiding away, and he has revealed himself in the Lord Jesus Christ. And this is how we need to approach people today. Today, as back then, the world is not that different. People don't change that much. Today, just as then, people create their own gods. People, they say, okay, I mean, if you just stop a bunch of random people on the street, and you say, what do you think God is like? Each one will say something different. Everyone has their own God. Well, I don't believe in a God who sends people to hell. Okay, where do you base that upon? Well, just don't like the idea. Oh, so the character of God is based upon what you like. Everyone just has a different God. Likewise, today, just as then, everyone has their own different philosophy on life. Everyone thinks that they're so much smarter from all the previous generations, they think they all have it figured out. And yet again, you ask every different person, each one has a different philosophy on life. Because they don't know. The Athenians didn't know. That's why they had the unknown God. Maybe there's something else out there. Maybe this philosophy is right. Maybe that one is. We don't know. We don't know. And the answer to that is, yes, there is truth. But truth is not based upon your opinion. Truth is not based upon your feelings. Truth has been revealed to us. We have a revelation from God. You don't have to go wondering what the truth is in darkness. God has revealed Himself through the Lord Jesus Christ, which is what Paul is going to say to them. And he's going to say to them that we know that that is the one whom God has approved of. And we know that because of the resurrection from the dead, which proves that He is the Son of God. So if you want to know truth, follow Christ. And that's what he's going to tell these people who have never heard of Him. And that's our message for today. Thank you for your attention. Let's pray.